As you said, I've been a monk now just over 36 years, and I have a great deal of fulfillment and happiness. Last night, I gave a talk to the Harvard and Cambridge alumni, and there's one thing I wanted to say there that I forgot, but I'm going to say now. It was actually while I was a student at Cambridge, when, as it were, the world was at your feet, you were about to have a great degree from a famous university, and it meant that there were so many doors open for you in life. And of all those possible careers I could have chosen, I chose to be a Buddhist monk. And the reason I chose to be a Buddhist monk was I wanted to have a life where I could fulfill two objectives. The first thing, I had to have my own personal happiness. But that was not enough for me. As well as having one's own personal happiness, I had to be able to be of use and serve the community in which I live. And when I saw how a Buddhist monk could have great happiness for themselves through their understanding of their mind and through the ability to calm their mind and let it go through meditation. But I also saw at the time just the amount of help and service they can give to people through the world. And so that's the path which I chose, a path of service to others balanced with your inner happiness. And I must admit, after 36 years of being a Buddhist monk, my objectives have been fulfilled way beyond what I ever expected. To be able to have so much peace and happiness as a Buddhist monk, and at the same time being able to have the privilege of teaching people and actually saving their lives. That book which was mentioned earlier, Opening the Door of Your Heart, that has been translated in over 20 languages now. It's very, very popular, not just in Thailand, but in many other countries. And I remember when the second edition came out with a new cover, just beforehand, a woman came to see me in my monastery just south of Perth in Australia. And she traveled all the way from Bern in Switzerland for one purpose only, and that was to try and find me. She told me that she had cancer, she had anxiety disorder, depression, and many other psychological problems. And her GP and doctors were having a hard time fixing it, until her GP gave her a copy of the German edition of my book. And she read that, and in 2 months she was in full remission. And her psychologist said, "You don't need to see me anymore. Your anxiety and depression are over." Now, that was a huge thing, to get life-threatening diseases and psychological trauma completely out of your system in such a short time, that she said, "I have to go and find that monk." And so she bought the ticket to Perth, and she found out where I was. And she was very fortunate. I was actually in the monastery at the time. If people came to see me today, they'll be very upset because I've been kidnapped by Thailand. And as soon as she saw I was there, she burst into tears. Because what you said in that book had actually literally saved her life. She burst into tears. Now imagine how I felt when you'd actually done something very big to help a person have a new life, without the fear and the pain of cancer, and without the trauma of a mind which is just so fearful. Many, many times that has happened. That's only one example, which actually shows, and I take no credit for this at all, because all the teachings which I have gratitude towards my teacher Ajahn Chah. It's because of Ajahn Chah that I could teach like this. And I have adapted many of his stories and also enhanced them for a modern audience. And of course Ajahn Chah has to pay respect to the Buddha. This is all the power of the Buddha's insight coming down over the many, many generations and many lands, going obviously here to Thailand and going to places like Australia, and really making a difference to people's lives, a real difference. This is not just something which helps people become interested in philosophy. This is something which changes people from the very inside and makes them see life in a totally different way. Another example is a couple of weeks ago, I married a supermodel. I like saying that because sometimes people think that, my goodness, Ajahn Brahma's got married. But the word to marry someone has two meanings. Either you're the groom or the bride, or it means you're the person who does the blessing. And obviously I was the person who did the blessing for this supermodel. And over in Malaysia. And you know, when you have a marriage, it can give you a lot of happiness and fulfillment, but it can also give you an enormous amount of suffering and trauma. It's one of the most important parts of a layperson's life. If they get it right, they're going to have a beautiful, happy life. If they get it wrong, it's enormous pain. And so, as a monk, you have to address, you know, the secrets of a happy relationship. And so I told that couple, as I tell every couple whose marriage I bless and give some teachings to, I told them that once you're married, you should never think of yourself. I like to do this by keeping eye contact with people, because, you know, in the West, if you don't look at people in the eyes, they actually distrust you. Obviously in Thailand we were told when I was a young monk, never look at people in the eyes, they get the wrong idea. You should always give a talk looking at the ground or with a fan in front of you. But in the West that doesn't work at all. So I'd actually look the bride in the eye and I'd tell her, from now on you should not think of yourself. And she always smiles sweetly. And then I look at the boy, the groom, and I say, from now on you should not think of yourself. And he thinks for a few minutes before he says yes. And then still looking at the groom, I tell him, from now on you should not think of your wife. And while he's confused, I look at his wife and said, from now on you should not think of your husband. Now, this is an ancient technique of teaching. In order to get people to listen very deeply, you confuse them first of all. And once you've confused them, they're wondering, what is the answer to this riddle? Interest keeps you aware and mindful. And so they're very interested. What does this crazy monk mean by this? I should not think of my partner and I should not think of myself. And the answer is, I tell them both, from now on you should not think of yourself, nor should you think of your partner. You should only think of us. And then they get it. It's never about me or them. It's always about us. And I think that many of you have been in a relationship or in a marriage, you know that sometimes if you sacrifice yourself to your partner, after a while you feel burnt out and very frustrated. It's all about your partner. And if you just think of it for yourself, it's called selfishness. That's not a relationship at all. And that other option, it's all about us, shows you the secret of that marriage, of how to live together in peace and in harmony, in great fulfillment. So if it is all about us, then when is a problem, whose problem is it? It's never your husband's problem, it's never your wife's problem, it is always our problem. And when it's our problem, there are two people finding a solution rather than one person giving all of that job to somebody else. And of course, in a marriage, it has to be our solution, because it is our problem. We're both involved. And little Buddhist teachings like that, very simple, have a huge effect and keep society a little bit happier. Whether it's in Thailand or the West, the number of divorces which we have in our modern world seem to be increasing all the time. And you can say that, well, that's just the fact that people like their freedom. There's a mistake there, because if any of you have been through a divorce and a separation, it's traumatic. It's one of the biggest amounts of suffering you'll ever experience in your life. And you want to try, Buddhism should try and help that and heal that so it doesn't really happen. And so this is, you know, why we teach like this, to try and keep people together. I remember talking to some kids in front of their parents who were having trouble. And I said, what would it be like if your parents separated? And the children thought that was a terrible, terrible thing to happen. And I asked them why. And I remember this little kid, he was only 6 years of age, said, well, you know, sometimes my mummy doesn't like me, but at least I've got a daddy to go to. Or if my daddy scolds me, I can always go to my mummy. If I've only got one parent, I've got no one to go to when she scolds me. Little things like that were actually showing how children, they have to have those two parents, and they will become much, much, much better people if their two parents are there for them, and if their parents can show the sense of harmony, that two different people with two different ideas can actually live together. Isn't that showing us that if two people can live together in peace and harmony, work out their differences, then maybe all the religions in the world can work out their differences and live together in peace and harmony. All the nations of the world, all the political parties in the world can work out their difference and learn how to work together for the sake of harmony and peace, because we all know what happens whenever there's disharmony in society for whatever cause. So it's important that we use these ancient Buddhist teachings to solve current world problems in a very, very big way. Of course, I was very fortunate. Not only did I manage to find Buddhism, but I was naturally gifted with two parents who showed me a lot of wisdom. My mother and father would fight and argue sometimes. And it's natural that we have disagreements and we do argue. But the one thing which I always remember from my upbringing, the arguments would not last very long before my father usually would get hold of my mother and hug her and kiss her and say sorry. They would make up. Then they would make up in front of their children. And what I learned from that experience was, yes, arguments are natural. We will have disagreements. That is part of the nature of life. But when we have those disagreements, the way to overcome them is never to think who's right and who's wrong. Instead, just to make up and just to say sorry and just to move forward. This is something which was reinforced when I started to study deeply into Buddhism. When I started reading books on Buddhism, and especially when you started reading the original teachings of the Buddha in the suttas and in the monastic discipline, the Vinaya, one thing which was very clear was there was no punishment. I was really surprised when I read all these rules for monks that if a monk made any mistake, all they needed to do was to confess it to one other monk, and the other monk would accept that confession and say, try and be more restrained in the future. And that was it. There was a natural amnesty, so that when you confessed your faults, you weren't punished, there was no penance necessary usually, and you just tried to learn from your mistakes to move forward. And I thought that that was such a wonderful thing to have in our general society, not just with monks. Because whenever there's a penance or a penalty involved, first of all, people will not admit their faults, because they're scared of what might happen if they tell the truth. I've often wondered, why is it that people lie? Why is it that even in a family people don't tell the truth? Why is it your children don't tell you the truth? If you just think a little bit deeply, you will know, because it's not in their interest telling you the truth. If they tell you what has really happened, they're afraid they'll be punished, or that you will shout at them or scold them. And having realized that, I've been telling people in countries like Australia and throughout the world, If we really want to have a society which is healed, a family which is harmonious, even a company which can do well in the tough economic climate of our modern world, we have to look at honesty and raise it so high that it's the most important thing, to the point that you tell your children there will always be amnesty for you as long as you tell the truth. To tell your children, I don't care what it is you've done, whether you've taken drugs or got your girlfriend pregnant or stolen something or whatever, as long as you tell mummy and daddy, we will never punish you. And only then will your children have the courage to come and tell you what they've been doing. And once they tell you what they've been doing, instead of punishing them, what they're saying is, look, we made a mistake. Mummy, daddy, we need your help so that we can get out of this problem and never have to do these terrible things again. But of course, if they fear you're going to punish them, shout at them and get angry at them, they will never let you know. But once there is that honesty there and they tell you what has happened, there are always many, many, many possibilities of strategies that we can do together to solve those problems, as long as the problems are not hidden. And even to the point of a marriage, if your husband comes up to you, wife, and tells you he's begun an affair with somebody, please don't scold him. If he's had the guts to do that, to come up and tell you that he's misbehaved, understand that he's done that because he still loves you, he wants you as his partner, and he wants you to help him. Otherwise he wouldn't come and tell you. So don't scold him, because if he realizes he's going to be scolded, he will hide that relationship and it will get worse and worse and worse. If he comes up and tells you he's made a mistake, number one, give him amnesty and say, darling, how can we help? It's our problem. How can we help to make sure, you know, that this doesn't happen? Let's change your telephone, change the SMS and your email number, whatever. Move you from that office if you're seeing the girl at work. Whatever it is. And once, you know, we work together, there's nothing we can't do together to solve those problems. But if it's hidden, it'll get worse and worse and worse, and it will break up your relationship. I've known many relationships which are like that. The husband has made a mistake, and I've encouraged him to tell his wife. And I've told his wife, for goodness sake, forgive him. Now, he's made a mistake, but he really wants you. And they work it out together, and that relationship just flourishes. He does it once, never ever again. And when a relationship is built on such forgiveness and trust, trust has to be built, it's not there from the beginning, then it's a beautiful relationship they have. I just remember one couple in particular. He was actually, you know, visiting the prostitutes, and which he found out. And, you know, he was just devastated that she found out. She was devastated that he was doing these things. They came to me for the counseling. Lord made him promise in front of me, in front of the Buddha, never, ever, ever again. And then I had to work on the wife to say, look, take him back. She did take him back, and now they have this wonderful relationship together. And it's so beautiful to see this couple coming to my temple every week to offer food, just out of gratitude to the monks for keeping their marriage together and keeping their family together. Many times that has happened. What's the alternative? The alternative is to think, I've been hurt, I'm going to hurt him. I just mentioned men being unfaithful, but it always takes two to tango. The woman in there is unfaithful too. So if it's the other way around, please forgive your wife. Have that honesty. And once there's that honesty there, make up and find strategies to make sure that thing never happens again. There was a woman in Singapore, a disciple, who was a marriage counselor. She told me this very wonderful story. One of her clients, this Singaporean woman, Chinese, she was very, very, very concerned about her husband. She was sure he was having an affair. He was coming back very, very late every evening. So she went to the counselor and said, "Look, I'm sure my husband's having an affair. Now, should I get divorced? Let's do a divorce." And the counselor said, "If you get divorced right now, your husband will be very happy, because then he has all the freedom to follow that affair. Is that what you want, your husband to be happy?" And she said, "No! He made me suffer, he should suffer." And so the counselor said, "Look, then I have a plan for you. What I want you to do," said the counselor, "is, you know, just go and get a proper hairdo, get some, you know, sexy clothes, you know, do some makeup, you know, be really kind to him. He fell in love with you once, make him fall in love with you again. And once he's fallen in love with you, then divorce him." And she said, "Yeah!" And that was the plan. Because she wanted to hurt him, because he hurt her. So she, you know, started dressing up really nice and getting some more fashionable clothes. And they would come and see the counselor every week. And the counselor would say, "How's it going?" And she said, "It's actually working. He's coming home earlier. He's becoming more affectionate towards me." And it took about 2 or 3 months. And every week, "Yeah, he's coming home earlier. He actually embraces me now." He said, "It's working. Look, soon he's going to fall in love with you, and then he can do the divorce. Yeah, yeah, the plan's working." And then for 2 appointments, this girl missed the appointments. And so the counselor called her at home. He said, "You've missed 2 appointments. So what's happened?" He said, "Oh, don't worry about those appointments. I'm having a good time." "You mean your husband's fallen in love with you?" "Yeah, he's fallen in love with me again now." "Great, divorce him," said the counselor. "Oh no," said the girl, "he's so nice now." And the counselor said, "Mission accomplished. That was my plan from the very beginning." That was a very wise counselor. Because that's all it really takes. And that was a true story of a couple who actually got together. She started dressing up, not to attract him, but actually to hurt him even more. But that was the plan. And she took the bait. And once they'd fallen in love again, they live happily ever after, literally. So these things can be done with a bit of Buddhist psychology. And I love teaching Buddhist psychology because in the Western world, you know, there is whole sections of universities devoted to Buddhist psychology, simply because the psychology which is used in the Western world, a lot of it doesn't work. And when they started hearing Buddhist psychology, they realize there's a whole treasury of ideas and strategies which are so powerful that, you know, I go off and teaching psychologists. I remember this one lady, this was in my hometown of Perth in Australia. She invited me to come and address her organization, which was an organization called ASSETS, that was the acronym, the Association of Survivors of Torture and Trauma. So many people migrating to countries like Australia have come from lands where you've been actually tortured. And some of the things which happen in those underground cells or in those houses, you know, in anonymous places, you know, that sort of makes your flesh creep when you hear what goes on and the amount of pain these people have to suffer. And these are people who've gone through hell in this life for many, many weeks or months, and they managed to somehow escape and find their way to a safe country like Australia. But even though now they are safe, they have those mental wounds called trauma. And the governments have to help them. And this woman who invited me, I asked her, "Why do you invite me to come and give a talk to you?" And she said, "Because, Ajahn Brahm, I got my degree from the university, but that was a piece of paper which allowed me to do this work. But everything practical and useful I learned from you and your monks." And it was actually the Buddhism which she was practicing for these people and telling them how to make use of these psychological principles which would actually help them let go of the pain of their past. I've already given you an instance of that. Buddhism, there's no guilt and there's no revenge, because it's karma we believe in. And look, if only people would have more understanding and acceptance of the law of karma, it doesn't matter who's done what to whom, you do not need to seek justice. Karma will give that justice. If you're a Christian or a Muslim, God will do the justice thing. Karma, God, is the agency of justice. He'll settle, you know, if someone thinks that something's been done wrong to you, they will get the karmic consequence of that later. The job of a human being is actually to forgive, not to punish. Karma will do the punishing. It was a great revelation to know that, because I hated punishing anybody. It never felt right to me. There's already pain has been made, and now I'm going to give them more pain by punishing them for something. That never ever made sense to me. What did make sense? Someone has done something wrong. Why did you do that? What were you thinking at the time that you were hurtful or cruel to somebody? And how can I make sure you never act like that ever, ever again? The classic story which I've been telling, I'm sure I told this in one of the talks I gave, I think probably at Poor Soul Law, the World Fellowship of Buddhists, a couple of days ago, was a story of one of my trainees in Perth. Now, I'm the abbot of a monastery. I don't actually call it a monastery, I call it a monk factory. So, you know, my job is to make monks, you know, like on the conveyor belt, I get raw materials in, and I want to turn out good monks at the end. That's actually one of the things I remember from Ajahn Chah. Just before he passed away, or rather before he had his stroke and stopped talking, one of the things he told me personally, he said he'd built many, many monasteries, but he hadn't made many monks. And that's actually from Lumpur Cha. And when he said that, I really realized that it's easy to build a monastery. And there are thousands and thousands of monasteries here in Thailand. But how many monks are there? I talked about really, really good monks. So really it's important, and I took that on board, that my job is not to build monasteries as much as building monks. Really good quality monks. So in my monk factory, one of the most important parts of my monk factory is QC, you know, quality control. So in order to have good quality control, you know, I have to really take an interest in training, you know, the people who come into my monastery. So when especially like Australians or Europeans, Americans, they come into our system, they have to stay as an 8 preceptor first of all, wearing white for 1 year. And after wearing white and keeping 8 precepts for 1 year, they take a novice ordination where they keep 10 precepts and wear the brown robes for 1 year. And only after 2 years, if they really have shown that they deserve to be ordained as a monk, then we give them ordination. So we don't make it easy for people. We really test them out before they can become a monk. Now, on this occasion, there was one of these young men who was on the first year of training, just keeping 8 precepts. And one afternoon, he came up to me, and he said he had not slept the night before. He felt guilty, because part of the 8 precepts is not eating anything after noon until the dawn of the next day. And in the afternoon, the day before, he had felt hungry. He had sneaked into the kitchen when no one was there and made himself a sandwich and ate it. He'd broken his precepts. Now, because he was a Westerner, he felt so guilty about that, he didn't sleep all night. And he came up to me to confess. And so he said, I've done this terrible thing, I've made a sandwich, and I've eaten it in the afternoon. And I told him, as I said earlier to you, in Buddhism we don't have any punishment, just so you acknowledge that. It's a wonderful thing that you've had the courage just to tell me, rather than keeping it to yourself and losing another night's sleep. Now, I said, Now you're forgiven, no punishment, but now make sure you eat something more at lunchtime, you know, before noon, so you're not so hungry. Eat a bit more so you don't have to eat in the afternoon. If you really do feel hungry in the afternoon, as a monk, there's all these other things we could drink. You know, have some orange juice, some apple juice, have a cup of tea, put an extra spoon of sugar or honey in there. You know, have some chocolate. Whatever, there's many, many things which monks can eat in the afternoon without breaking their precepts, which are allowable. And so I told him all of these things, what he can do, to make sure he doesn't need to break that rule ever again. And I said, you can go now. And he said, aren't you going to punish me? I said, no. And he said, that's not good enough. He said, I need to be punished. If you don't punish me, Ajahn Brahm, I will do the same thing again. So Westerners are like that, and some Thais are like that as well now. So I had to think of a punishment for this young man. And I thought and thought, and I remembered that that morning I'd been reading a history book about Australia. And those of you who know how Australia was founded, it was the English sent all their convicts over to Australia. It was a very clever idea of emptying their jails in England and dumping them in this far-off land. So much of Australia started as a convict colony. And those poor convicts were treated so cruelly. And if they did make any mistakes, they were flogged. And they were flogged with a terrible instrument called a cat of nine tails, this whip with nine thongs. And I'd just been reading about descriptions of those floggings. They were just fresh in my mind. So when this young Australian asked for punishment, I say, I have a traditional Australian punishment for you, 50 strokes of the cat. And this young Australian, he was wearing white clothes as you're supposed to wear when you're keeping eight precepts. But my goodness, his face went whiter than his clothes. He thought, oh my goodness, Ajahn Brahm's going to flog me. That's not what he expected. And then I had to tell him what 50 strokes of the cat means in a Buddhist monastery. We had two cats. Find one of them and stroke it. One, two, three. Stroke that cat 50 times because your penance is learning some compassion and kindness. Because that's the thing you were missing. The only reason why we seek revenge or we want punishment is because we don't have enough metta, enough compassion for ourselves. One of the greatest places to learn kindness is by taking a small pet, a little animal, and just being kind to it, stroking it. So 50 strokes of the cat is the only punishment we have in our monastery when people do very bad things. In other words, metta practice. So if you have done anything wrong, any terrible, terrible things in your life, and you feel guilty, please come up and I'll give you 50 strokes of a cat or a kitten as your punishment so you can learn some forgiveness. Otherwise, you are going to be carrying the pain of the past with you all your life. Why do so many people get cancers and other diseases? Why are they so stressed out? It's not just the work. It's the worry. It's the mental pain. When you're sort of worrying about what happened in the past and the terrible things which were done, and you will not let them go. Even a country sometimes carries the pain of the past and will not let it go. I do not think that when we have these trials or these commissions to find out what really happened, you know, in these conflicts within countries and between countries. Psychologically, as a Buddhist, I don't think that's helpful at all. There was one going on in Cambodia, which was trying to find out, you know, exactly what happened during that genocide of in the Pol Pot Khmer Rouge days. I know many Cambodians who were there at the time who suffered enormously. They didn't want that to happen at all. They wanted to move on. It was Western governments were pushing that. And very often I quoted the wonderful thing which happened in South Africa after Nelson Mandela was released from prison after 26 years in jail, became the president of the country within the next year. And with his incarceration in jail for 26 years of his life, just for doing something which was, these days we think, was heroic, fighting for the freedom of his people, he had all opportunity, all the levers of power of, as president of a state, to exercise revenge on the people who'd taken away 26 years of his freedom. And what did he do with that opportunity to exercise revenge? Forgiveness. And together with this great Anglican, Desmond Tutu, they started something which was very, very Buddhist, which I think the Buddhist countries should try and emulate, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. That Truth and Reconciliation Commission worked on the following ideals. As long as you were honest, as long as you admitted what you'd done, no matter how terrible that was, even murder, as long as you admitted the truth, you would be given amnesty. You'd be able to walk out of that courtroom or auditorium and nothing would be done. Now you can see what I said earlier. Honesty was so important that without that amnesty, people wouldn't have the guts, the courage, to come and admit what they had done. They would hide it. They think they can't confess, otherwise it's not in their interest. So when you make honesty possible for people, and you encourage honesty, then look what happened next. Many, many people from both sides, from the South African security forces and the police, from the African National Congress, the ANC, they had done all of these tie necklaces where they put these tires around people's necks, filled them with kerosene and lit them. It was a torturous way to die. That was their way of punishing, you know, their members who didn't fall into line. There was so much terrible things done on both sides. But I remember the story which I read and which made me cry and made many other people cry, even get emotional now just thinking about it, was a typical story where a South African police officer had the guts to confess in public how he had tortured and killed, especially in front of the man's wife. This African National Congress worker had disappeared in the middle of the night. No one knew what had happened to him. His family feared the worst, and now they were finding out in detail what had happened from the mouth of the person who had inflicted all this torture and had killed him. You can imagine the tension in that courtroom at the time. The South African policeman was shaking, crying, but he had to get it out. The wife, the widow, was learning how the man she had chosen, the one she had loved more than everybody else, the father of her children, how he had spent his last days before he was murdered. When this man finished his testimony, the widow jumped up and the court guards were unable to stop her as she lunged for that South African murderer. They were supposed to stop these things happening, but they weren't quick enough. She was faster. They thought she was going to take revenge. But instead, this widow, who had just a second or two before heard how her husband had been murdered, threw her big black arms around this shaking South African white person, hugged him and said, "I forgive you. I forgive you," she said. And everybody in that courtroom wept. That's beautiful. That shows what's possible. If a woman who has just heard how her husband was killed and tortured for no reason at all except politically fighting for what he believed in. He hadn't done any crime, he hadn't murdered or killed anybody or stolen things. But she could actually forgive him. The reason people cried was because it showed them what is possible in our modern world. Even that degree of pain and so-called injustice, the woman who was hurt and harmed more than anybody else could say the words, "I'm sorry, I forgive." So say the word, "I forgive you." I mention that very often because if she could do that, can't you forgive your husband if he has had an affair? Can't you forgive your kid if he's taken drugs? Can't you forgive someone who maybe has stolen from you? No need for revenge. That will just keep the problem going day after day, year after year. But it's not just that forgiveness. You have to also say, right, let's make sure this never ever happens again. Let's make sure we put strategies in place so that we don't have these terrible, terrible incidents anymore. Kid, I'm going to make sure, why did you take those drugs in the first place? But thank you, thank you, thank you for telling mummy or daddy. Now let's make sure that, you know, you don't hang out with those people who sold you those things. Let's make sure that you don't take those things or whatever. And there's no end of strategies which we cannot put in place to solve the problems of the future. But when we're lingering in the past with revenge and justice, there's no way forward in the future. We waste so much time as human beings on the past, trying to find who did what and why, and exerting revenge on them, that we do not spend enough time in the present and the future making sure that our world and our society, our nation, our family are going to be happy. We just spend too much time on a past which cannot be changed by punishing the actors in that tragedy of the past. Buddhists, we leave it to karma. So when you start talking like this, you can see it's giving people a new way of looking at life, of moving forward in a family, in a nation, in the world, in such a way it restores hope to our society. I often say, wouldn't it have been an amazing, wonderful experience if after 9/11, George Bush would have got on TV and said, "I forgive you, all you people who blew up the Twin Towers, on behalf of the American people, we forgive you." That would have had shockwaves throughout the world. It means we wouldn't have any terrorists now. It would mean that I would be able to travel to Bangkok without having to take out my toothpaste and have it confiscated. I'd be able to keep my shoes on. You wouldn't have to take your belts off. Why can't we say, "I forgive"? So this is how the Buddha taught. You know that, please actually have a read of those original teachings of the Buddha, especially the Vinaya. These are like the rules. Sometimes we think, oh, that's just monks' business or nuns' business. No, you've got some great, great teachings of Dhamma in there. You know, remember this Devadatta tried to kill the Buddha, and he sent these assassins to murder the Buddha. And someone came to murder you. And what do? Did you call the police and have them arrested? No. He sort of gave them a Dhamma teaching. They became stream winners and disciples of the Buddha afterwards. Now that's the way to solve problems. So by knowing this, there's a different way of using this ancient wisdom, you know, for our modern world. But let's look at some other problems of the modern world. Look, what about the, sort of all the sicknesses, the physical sicknesses of our modern world? I haven't been into one of the Thai hospitals recently. I never have time to do that, but I don't know why it is. Every time I go to Singapore, the first thing I do when I land is someone takes me to see someone who's sick in the hospital to give them some chanting. That's going to happen tomorrow when I've already been told, as soon as I land at Changi Airport, straight to the hospital to visit someone who's sick. And I was really surprised going through the cancer wards in, I think, the Singapore General Hospital. Ward after ward after ward after ward after ward after ward. I couldn't believe how many people have got those cancers. What the heck's going on in our society that we get so many people with tumors? So easy to understand. We are so stressed out. We already have to work very hard. So why on earth are you lingering at the pain of the past and worried about who did what to who? Why are you so guilty about what you happen to do? You know, when I haven't done very many bad things in my life. You know, I've been a monk. I've had a very fortunate life. You know, my mother told me I was bald when I came out of her womb, so that was a good sign I was going to become a monk. So I was always a bit sort of monkish, even when I was very small. But you know, one thing I did, I always felt really, really guilty about. I got a job as a student, because I came from a poor family. I had to get scholarships, because there's no way my family could afford to send me to a good school or a university. So every vacation time, I was out working. You know, one of the jobs I got, the worst job in the world, selling encyclopedias door to door. I did that. It's a terrible job. And it was actually a children's encyclopedia. And that children's encyclopedia was rubbish. If it was really worth anything, you wouldn't need to sell it. They'd buy it at a bookshop. And the worst thing was, I sold one. And I went to this house and I did all of the sales pitch. And this was this young couple who just, you know, had a young child, maybe 1 or 2 years of age. And I made them feel that they were no better than child molesters if they did not buy this amazing encyclopedia. They obviously did not love their child, and they were making sure their child didn't really do well at school, wouldn't have not got any chance in life if they didn't make use of this amazing encyclopedia for their kid. And they believed it and they bought it. And I felt so bad after that. You know, I gave up the job the next day. You know, if I could remember where they lived, I would have gone and given them the money back. I felt terrible, and I kept that for years. It's amazing how guilt, it's small things we carry around with us. And I remember giving a talk on guilt over in Perth one evening to my group over there. And I mentioned that story about me as a student going from door to door selling children's encyclopedias, and I sold one, and I felt so bad about it, but I could forgive myself now. I was a stupid young man and didn't really know what I was doing. And after my talk, this girl came up to me and she said, "You spooked me. This is really weird. Because about that time, when I was a young girl, I remember this young student came to my house and sold my parents' encyclopedia. And she said, I love that encyclopedia. It was my favorite book. I don't know if it was you. It's too much of a coincidence, but it could have been you. So don't feel guilty. That was the most wonderful book in my whole life." So sometimes the things you feel guilty about, you know, we exaggerate. That's the other thing which, you know, I learned as a monk, just to solve the problems of life, we exaggerate things out of all proportions. I still remember the story just here in Thailand. You know when you go on tudong? Tudong is when the monks, you leave the monastery and you take these umbrellas, these glots. You know, they have the mosquito screen on the outside. And you go off into the jungle, find quiet places to meditate. And you do that at night time. So you're in the jungle and it's totally dark. You've got a little flashlight. And there you're meditating late at night. And, you know, this in those days, in those jungles, there were some very, very fierce animals. There were tigers around and elephants and bears. But, you know, the chances of a tiger coming to you were very, very, you know, very rare. So there I was, sitting, meditation. Sort of late in the night, maybe 10 o'clock. And that's when I heard a sound. It was a jungle animal. You can tell the sounds because there's so many leaves and twigs that when anything moves, you can hear it. And of course, I stopped my meditation just to, you know, to test out what sort of animal was that. And I was very mindful, very aware, and I assessed that it's only a small animal, it doesn't matter. So I carried on meditating. And then it disturbed me again. Because I realized, you know, from the sound, this wasn't a small animal. This was like a medium-sized one. Maybe it could be a civet cat, or maybe, you know, something around that size. And it was coming towards me. So I thought, civet cats, they're okay, they won't sort of do any harm. So I stopped listening and just carried on watching my breathing. And then as it came closer, I realized that no, this is not a small animal, this is a large animal. And then I started getting afraid, and this is a large animal, that could be a bear, it could be a tiger. Maybe only a small tiger, but they're still dangerous. So that's when I started getting a bit afraid. Instead of breathing in, breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out. And I was really listening carefully.
You know, my mindfulness was, you know, half focused on my breath, but mostly focused on this sound. And as it came, I had to have my eyes closed. As it came closer, it wasn't a small tiger. That was a big animal. That was a huge tiger, or it was an elephant. Because that's what it sounded like. You know, you were actually listening with all of your senses, acute. And I realized, my goodness, I was in trouble. That was a huge tiger coming towards me. And it was that time I opened my eyes and got out my flashlight, as you would, to shine it towards this thing coming to you to find out exactly what it was and how big that tiger was. As I focused the flashlight on the sound, I saw this was this tiny mouse. That's what it was, just a mouse. And I couldn't believe what I was seeing, because I was being so mindful that it sounded like a tiger. And I realized that's what fear does. Fear makes a mouse sound like a tiger. It shocked me at the time. These things exaggerate. So those of you who are afraid, I've got a cancer. No, don't be afraid. It just makes small things like mountains. So one of the things which I learned from those experiences, don't be afraid. And if you get afraid, you actually create the cancers. Now when I was a kid, I got my first bicycle. I don't know if you remember when you first rode a bicycle. I was so scared of falling off. I gripped those handlebars and my knuckles were white. And I was so afraid, I was so stiff, I kept on falling off. Because my body was too rigid with fear to be able to move when the bike turned the corners. And I only learned afterwards, if you relax when you're on a bicycle, on a motorbike, when you really relax, you don't tend to fall off. Have any of you ever figured out how it is that when birds, they go to sleep on the twigs and branches of trees at night time, they go unconscious as they go to sleep? Why don't they fall off? If I went to sleep on a branch, I'd fall off after 5 minutes, and so would you, especially if the wind is blowing. Those trees are swaying backwards and forwards. Now how on earth can those birds get any rest? Surely they're gripping on for their dear life, afraid if they let go, they'll fall off. But I've never seen a dead bird fall off a tree at night time. Until somebody told me the secret. You know, with birds, they've got their claws, you know, and their sort of, what do they call their feet or whatever, their claws anyway. The more they relax, the more it closes. Really, really relax, and it's totally closed. And when they wake up in the morning, they have to put effort in to actually open their claws to fly off. Which is why when they really go to sleep on those branches, they are the safest. Because that's when things relax and they just cling on naturally with no effort whatsoever. And they realize if you have fear, you fall off. If you relax, you stay safe. What a great simile that is in life. People who have fear tend to get the cancers. If you have fear when you're doing an examination or an interview, you stuff up, you fail. If you really relax, you're usually very successful in all you do. I'll finish off with one last story, then open up for questions. This story was told to me by a friend, a monk who lives in Sydney. In the 2000 Olympic Games in Sydney, the Australian government, or rather the New South Wales government, they built all the facilities, including the Athletes' Village in Homebush Bay. And they provided religious chaplains of all the major denominations to serve the athletes' spiritual needs throughout that very tense time of the 2 weeks of the Olympic Games in 2000 in Sydney, Australia. So because some athletes are Buddhists, not many, they had a Buddhist monk there to serve the needs of any Buddhist athletes in that village. He told this story, which was repeated in the Sydney Morning Herald, about a Russian athlete and her two parents who came to see him one afternoon. And they said that we were not Buddhists, but our daughter, the athlete, had exceeded her
expectations and everybody's expectations, and had made it into the final of the 800 meters sprint.
800 meters sprint, Olympic Games. That's big time. And this poor little athlete was so afraid, was so nervous, not only could she not train, she couldn't even sleep at night, worrying about in 2 days she would be facing the cameras of the world in the biggest event of her life, the Olympic Games final. And that would make anyone nervous. And even though she wasn't, that no one was a Buddhist in her family, the one thing they do know is that Buddhists are the experts on meditation. The Buddha invented it. Now, we're the ones who've carried all these great teachings of meditation over the centuries. It was just a shame we never applied for the franchise or for the patent on meditation. But of course, you know, we don't have franchises and patents. Everyone can learn meditation, no matter what faith, what religion, what gender, or what nationality. But it's generally accepted that the Buddhist monks, we're the experts. So they took their daughter to the expert, the Buddhist monk, and begged him, please teach our daughter some meditation. Teach her how to relax. You know, she's not even sleeping, let alone training, and she's going to compete in a couple of days' time. So the monk taught her some meditation, just basic meditation. The sort of thing like this. This is my teaching on meditation. It's very easy. I teach this to corporates. Here we go. This is my visual aid. I don't need PowerPoint. I just need a glass of water. How heavy is this cup of water, or this glass of water? How heavy is it? The answer is, the longer I hold it, the heavier it feels. If I keep holding this for 2 minutes, my arm starts to ache. After 5 minutes, I'm in pain. And after 10 minutes, I'm in agony and a very stupid monk. What should I do when it starts to get heavy? What should I do? Just put it down. You don't need to throw it away. Just put it down and rest for 10 or 15 seconds. When you pick it up again, yeah, it feels lighter. Try it yourself. It works. You carry something, when it hurts, when it gets heavy, put it down and rest. And after you've rested, when you pick it up, it's much lighter. That's meditation. Holding something for too long is called stress. No, stress has got nothing to do with how much work you have and how many responsibilities and duties you have in your life. Stress has got nothing to do with that. Stress has got everything to do with you don't know how to put things down and relax. You carry your burdens 24 hours of the day. So that's what this girl was doing. She wasn't competing today. That was a couple of days, so relax. Learn how to put things down. Monks don't watch TV, so this monk never knew what happened. Until a couple of days later, when she saw the family coming towards him in the village. She saw, as he described it, the parents were on either side and the athlete was in the middle. They came from in the distance, so he could just recognize who they were first of all. And as they came closer, he noticed that they were smiling. Ah, something good must have happened. The next thing he noticed was the athlete in the middle. The way the monk described it was that she was swinging something on a string. When he got closer, he realized that string was a ribbon, and on the end of it was a medal, and that medal was gold. And they'd come to say thank you to the monk for teaching their daughter how to relax to the point that she exceeded her potential. She did what her coach and the other experts thought was impossible. She won the 800 meters Olympic Games final simply because we taught her how to relax, let go of stress. Now that's how powerful these Buddhist teachings are for our modern world. The psychology, the ideas to solve huge problems in our world. And I don't know how many gold medals did Thailand get in the last Olympic Games? Did they get any gold medals in the last Olympic Games? No, the Olympic Games, go for the big one. Look, 2 years' time, we've got the London Olympics. Come on. Now, there's so many great meditation teachers in Thailand. Just get everybody who's in the Thai team to learn meditation. I can't teach them, otherwise I'd get in trouble with Australia. They won't let me go back again. Teach people how to relax, and they will achieve beyond their expectations. That's some timeless wisdom for our modern times. Thank you for listening.